I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides healthcare to the world's poorest communities. Paul has essentially created public healthcare systems in developing countries, providing free drugs to patients who have AIDS or multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. He spent his career trying to get policymakers and the general public to understand the link between poverty and disease, which he calls the twin epidemics. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica, for having me.
Could you please describe what Partners in Health is?
Well, first of all, I think that was a great description, so thank you. Legally, and I feel self-conscious saying legally, it's a public charity. We're based in the United States in one sense, the headquarters here, but really what we do is build sister organizations wherever we work. And our biggest projects are in Haiti. And even though people know more perhaps about some of our work with tuberculosis or AIDS, as you just said, we're really interested in poverty reduction and in basic rights, not just the right to health care, which is hard enough, but the right to clean water, the right to primary education, and other basic entitlements. So I guess if I had to say what I think Partners in Health is, it would almost be some sort of human rights organization that focuses on the needs of families living in poverty. And of course, sickness is a huge part of that.
How did you come to the decision to devote your life to providing health care in developing countries? Where did that come from?
I made that decision in Haiti when I was 23 years old. And of course, I had to get to Haiti, so I must have had reasons to do that. And the reasons I gave myself back when I was in college was that I had met Haitians in the migrant farm worker stream. So these are seasonal laborers who are, you know, pushed out of their country by poverty and political violence and end up in our country, in my country, doing menial labor, harvesting crops from Florida all the way to upstate New York. I just got very interested in what they were doing and the conditions under which they labored, and started having some conversations that I just, you know, still to this day I feel like I'm having the same conversation. You know, why would you leave Haiti to come here and work under these conditions?
Now, how did you come into contact with them initially?
Well, initially, when I was a kid in Florida. So I'm not sure, you know, when you're a kid, you make these connections that may or may not prove salient later in life. But as a student in college, I really got interested.
And that you went to Duke?
I went to Duke.
With this interest in mind, what did you do after graduation?
When I graduated from Duke, I got this prize, which was for, of all things, it was about Haitian artists. And it was $1,000, and I thought, well, you know, I've read the books about Haiti. They say that the per capita income is about 300 and something. So I thought, oh, I could make that do for a year, and off I went.
How did you make your way ultimately to Cange, which was the place that Partners in Health really was born initially?
I made a contact in a town in central Haiti with a Haitian priest named Fritz Lafontaine. He was living in this town but doing mission work, and he was very focused on, again, these basic social rights, schools particularly. And I thought, well, if I go with him, maybe I could work on the healthcare part of it.
And from my understanding, Cange is one of the poorest parts of Haiti, which, I mean, Haiti itself is pretty poor, but Cange is even a multitude above that. Can you describe what it looked like when you were there
Well, sure, I'll give it a try. It was a squatter settlement. I think that if you look at really for poverty in the poor world, the most difficult places are the urban slums, and probably squatter settlements where landless peasants go. And peasant sounds like a strange word, although it's a word that the Haitians use to describe themselves. These people, who later founded Cange, had fled a hydroelectric dam project. And their valley, where they lived for many generations, was flooded. And so they just went up into the hills. And Cange was one of those small squatter settlements where people didn't own the land, and they were living in ramshackle huts. And so it was very, it looked like it just been thrown up hastily. That the houses were, you know, made out of twigs, and they had dirt floors, and it was a very dispirited place back then. And it looks very different now, but that's what it looked like in 1983 to me. Very dusty and dry also.
one sign of poverty is tin roofs that people have on their houses, but the Cange inhabitants didn't even have tin roofs. They didn't have that luxury. They had twig roofs.
That's right. They had thatch roofs. And they spoke a lot about this. You know, I had this association in my mind of tin roofs and poverty, and then I found out, well, there's something a lot worse than that. Dirt floors, really mud floors, because it rains there, you know, half the year or a good part of the year. So it was a real mess.
How emotionally tied were you to Cange after living among these people for a few months? Was it the type of feeling where you said, okay, I'm going to stick with them and then just go back to med school in Boston and go on with my life? Or was there some sort of visceral connection to these people?
Well, it felt visceral. It still feels visceral to me. Now that I work as much in Africa this past year, I've been in Rwanda. I've been in Rwanda a lot more than I was in Haiti this past year, but that's still home for me.
There's a book about you by Tracy Kidder called Mountains Beyond Mountains, and one of the sort of the visual takeaways I had was the U.S. government actually being complicit in this dam project. They might have had benign incentives, who knows, but the results were pure squalor. And these inhabitants just one day saw the water rising and had to take their most precious belongings and run into the mountains. And that gives you an example of the sort of urgency behind their homelessness.
Well, you know, the first time I heard them say that that's what happened, I thought they were taking poetic license. You know, I thought, well, surely they didn't leave the day the water rose. I mean, there's this giant buttress dam being built, you know, 10 kilometers away. Surely they knew what was coming. But when I heard the same story again and again, I realized they weren't exaggerating. They really didn't understand what was happening, and so they didn't have time to erect, you know, new houses or to move properly, and that's really what happened.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides health care to the world's poorest populations. Paul started Partners in Health in Haiti in his 20s while he was still a Harvard Medical School student. Partners in Health operates in Haiti, Peru, Rwanda, and Russia. You spent a couple of years surveying the conditions of these people, going house to house, before building your first clinic in 1985. How did you go about building that first health clinic?
Well, first we had to look for money, and there was a connection, a church connection, that the priest had, and all of us also sought money. And I was lucky because I met in Boston, when I came for my Harvard Medical School interview, I made a connection that later led me to meet Tom White, who is a Boston businessman, and he gave an anonymous donation to a charity in Boston, which he designated for Haiti. So some $5,000 came to us back in 1983, maybe early 1984, and we built a bread oven, which proved to be a mistake, by the way, talking about entrepreneurship. Wasn't a good idea, but anyway, it sounded good at the time. And then I came back to Harvard and wrote an essay about this experience. And he read the essay. The director of the charity to which he'd contributed sent him the magazine, and he read it and he said, I'd like to meet this guy, Paul Farmer. And the first time I met him was in Port-au-Prince at the airport.
But I think you missed an interesting point, which is you said to the organization, if he wants to meet me, he has to come to Haiti.
That sounds kind of sassy now. He's been so generous.
So what gave you that moxie or that gall almost to say, okay, if this potential funder wants to meet me, he has to come to Haiti?
Yeah, I look back on that and think that it proved to be a good strategy, but I think it was a little bit too much moxie, actually. But it worked out great because that's where we met, and we have been friends and coworkers ever since, actually. And I say coworkers, you know, some people would say, well, you were a medical student, and he was a Boston developer, you know, and so he's your funder. But actually, that's not the case. He was really one of the founders of Partners in Health and a funder.
What do you do to open up a healthcare clinic? You got the locals to help build a one-room building, or walk me through that.
So it was building a team locally. It was a lot of young people, Haitians, people about my age, and it was recruiting some medical staff in Haiti. It was keeping our supporters engaged and letting them know this was going to be a long-term project. And then it was designing this clinic, which, in my view, we designed very poorly. And we really had to take it down because, and redo it, because when we built it, we didn't think ahead about the flow and the traffic. You know, it should have been obvious that in a country that poor and that sick, where there are not other clinics available to really poor people, that we'd be overwhelmed. And so you really had to, we should have given more thought to how to lay it out. You know, we saw thousands of patients in the first year in 1985, maybe even tens of thousands. But last year, across our networks in Haiti, which is not just Cange now, but seven different towns, we had 1.2 million patient exchanges. So, and as you were kind enough to say, it's really a public health system. So, you know, that takes thought. We spent a lot of time trying to think, how will the patients move through the system? You know, and actually drawing arrows on pieces of paper and say that, you know, trying to plan their trajectory so it's not a mess, you know, not a traffic jam. And that's how it was in 1985. It was just a traffic jam. And so for years we grew and grew, and then in 1993 we put in a hospital facility right there in Cange.
Was there any problem with your credibility, or were these people so desperate they just came to the clinic because they had no other choice?
Well, we didn't have a big credibility problem early on. We really didn't. And part of it was due to the great need. The other part I would like to think was due to the fact that we really took our time to find out what people needed. We were actually going to their homes and saying, you know, what is it that you need? What are your problems? Some of it's so obvious, you know, if you're hungry, you need food. And if your children are unvaccinated, you need vaccines. And if you're injured, you need a physician who can stitch you up. Getting really rooted in that. In those communities, it's because it was always many communities. I think that was one of the reasons we had credibility.
And sometimes part of the cure is just having somebody to be able to talk to. The fact that you were able to listen to these people was medicinal in a way.
I'd like to think so, yeah. And, you know, speaking their language, that helps a lot.
There are stories of you walking for 4 hours on foot, going to one patient's home to make sure that he was taking his medication. Is that true?
That's true, yeah. It's not true just of me. It's true. We try to inculcate that value in all of our doctors and nurses. And there's no tradition of that in the United States or in Haiti or in Rwanda or in Peru. And so pushing that as a model, saying, you know, we really need to do this, even if it doesn't seem like the best use of your time, getting to know, you know, the way people live and getting to know their families and seeing their problems firsthand in their homes, in their communities, is a good thing. We've stuck with that over the years.
When you're walking, did you ever think, like, what am I doing?
Yeah, I still think that. You know, I still think, is this really going to work? Is this, you know, can we really pull this off?
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health. We'll hear more from Paul coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that provides healthcare to the world's poorest communities. Paul has essentially created public healthcare systems in developing countries, providing free drugs to patients who have AIDS or multidrug-resistant tuberculosis. He spent his career trying to get policymakers and the general public to understand the link between poverty and disease, which he calls the twin epidemics. Just to give one a sense of how destitute these people were that you were serving, Tracy Kidder, there's a quote in his book where a 13-year-old comes to you. She needed a spinal tap, you determined, and she was screaming, crying. She said, "It hurts. I'm hungry." And you said, "Can you believe it? Only in Haiti would a child cry out that she's hungry during a spinal tap." Do you remember that?
I do. I'm glad he wrote that down because, otherwise I probably would have forgotten it. But it was incredibly vivid. But then I get stunned like that every week that I'm, you know, in these places. I was in Rwanda in March, and we were rounding in the morning, and now I'm sort of I'm the grandfather. I'm the oldest guy around there. I'm 46, but you know I've been at this a long time. But by 10 o'clock in the morning, we'd see a guy who was bitten by a cobra, and two boys who should have been in school but weren't in school because they were poor, who mistook a landmine for a toy and picked it up. You know, it's just stunning to think about what would happen to these people if they didn't have access to health care as a right, you know, as something other than a commodity to buy. I think a lot of people are more aware of what's happening, say, in Africa or even Haiti, and the poorer parts of the world, and how these diseases are not dissociable from poverty.
I think one of your Haitian patients said it best, which was giving people medicine for tuberculosis and not giving them food is like washing your hands and drying them in dirt.
You know, I heard that several times from several patients. It would be so much easier if we could say, okay, we're gonna make sure patients with AIDS get antiretrovirals, or that, you know, women get modern obstetric care. But it's just the beginning. You know, and it's hard enough to do the medical work, the public health work. But then you have to think about, you know, water and housing and land rights, land tenure and seed prices and fertilizer prices and fair markets and debt relief. It just goes on and on. And, you know, but that's what we do.
I'm curious about your personal life during those years when you were so focused on your medical education, but also building this organization in Haiti. Did you ever feel like I'm missing out on, you know, a larger social life, or missing things at home? Or were you so steadfast that didn't even come up?
Well, I you know, sure, it's hard to, you know, do this work and to travel so much. But I feel that other people are missing out on social life. Mm-hmm. They're the ones missing out. This is what social life, the social world is like. You know, it's a world of rich and poor, of people dying of malaria when there are treatments right nearby, you know, of millions of people with AIDS and tuberculosis, you know, who don't ever get the drugs. That's what social life is to me, I've got to say. I don't say that in a defensive way. You know, mm-hmm. people should do what they want, but I think the work that we're doing gives us great meaning in our lives. You know, I'm very proud of my daughter, who's not even 9, but she, you know, raises money for the pediatric pavilion in Rwanda, and she likes working there and being there. Her interest in this work is genuine.
Today you're wearing a really nice suit. In the book that Tracy Kidder wrote, he said that when you went out to start raising money, you had one suit, and it was a black suit. And you really liked that suit because you could write prescriptions and, you know, wipe the ink on your suit and travel then to Russia for 10 hours, and the suit still looked like it was in top shape when you got there.
It's an indestructible suit.
And, by the way, your wallet was a plastic bag. Where does this frugality of yours come from?
Oh, I'm not frugal, Jessica. I just, I'm just, you know, you get focused on this work, and you know, other things somehow seem less important. You know, you're around people who are you know, dying for just lack of food, and my response is not to say, well, I should not have food. You know? And I hope I've never been sanctimonious like that or scrupulous, but it does put, you know, creature comforts out of one's mind sometimes. But I don't think I'm frugal in that way.
But you did have a kind of a frugal upbringing, and you were born in North Adams, Massachusetts, in the Berkshires, and your family moved to Alabama, and you spent most of your earlier life in Alabama and Florida.
That's right.
You lived in a bus. How did you go about living in a bus?
Well, I had no say in the matter since I was about 9. but we lived in, it's the funny thing about it is it was actually a bus that had been used to screen people for tuberculosis. My father just built all these bunks inside, and we lived in it. And, you know, you get used to anything as a kid.
There was a story that one day you went to school in a car.
The staff car.
The staff car, and you said, Dad, please don't drop me off in front of school. I'm embarrassed.
I didn't say that. It wasn't just me. It was all 6 of us.
There were 6 siblings. And your dad pulled up to the front of the school. Well, you tell the story.
My father did not cotton to pretense, and he had these ridiculous cars. He bought this car from the government. You know, the government sells off its surplus, and you can bid. It's called a sealed bid, and you bid on it. And my father bid $288 for that car, remember. It had said U.S. property of the U.S. Army on the side, and he just took a spray paint can and spray painted it. And, of course, we were mortified that he would drop us off, you know, near the school in that car. And I don't know, maybe it was me, but I don't think it was me. Someone made the mistake of saying, don't drop us off into the school. And he actually drove into the bus lane where it says buses only and honking the horn and said, that'll teach you.
Did you think your dad was strange at all?
No, I didn't.
Up?
I mean, no, I didn't think he was strange. He was obviously different from other people's fathers. You know, I didn't know anyone else who lived in a bus. But strange, no. I thought he was really smart and remarkable and interesting. And you know, he taught us all a lot. And so now I'm very grateful to him.
Also, you're quite precocious, and there's a great story about you. When you were 11 years old, you read the Lord of the Rings trilogy, and you went to the library and said, can you please give me something else like this? And they gave you other, you know, mystery and adventure books, and you came back, you said, no, this is not what I'm looking for. And at 11 years old, you were given War and Peace, and you came back and you said, this is just like Lord of the Rings.
Well, it is. You have to admit.
How does an 11-year-old know that, though?
I don't know. I'm very lucky that I had that love of reading, which a lot of my siblings had. You know, we were stuck in the bus or the boat, and not a lot to do. And my parents, I mean, they didn't really like us to go far away, and so we all read a lot.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that strives to alleviate disease and poverty among the world's poorest populations. Paul got Partners in Health off the ground while he was a student at Harvard Medical School in the 1980s. Going back to Partners in Health, how did you go from a one-off clinic in Haiti to now an international organization with a presence in places like Mexico and Rwanda and even Boston, Massachusetts?
Well, it grew sort of organically for a long time. We went from Haiti to Peru, for example. I said organically. What does that mean? Well, we started in 1988, I think, a very good tuberculosis control program in Haiti, which is focused on community health workers, making sure they could visit the patients. Because although many of us doctors are honored to make four-hour treks to see patients, you can't run a program that way. You have to get lots of people doing that. And when we developed this expertise, we found ourselves in the middle of a major epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis in Peru. We had personal connections to Peru. We'd promised that we'd work there. And then that dragged us to Siberia, where we found out there was an even more troubling epidemic of drug-resistant tuberculosis there, largely in the prisons. And the way we got to Boston was we started having these very good outcomes with tuberculosis and later AIDS. And, you know, you work in a Harvard teaching hospital and someone rolls in the door to the emergency room, they're sick because they're not really taking their medicines for AIDS or tuberculosis. And they weren't doing well. And so we started asking questions, why aren't they doing well right here in the shadows of, you know, Boston's biggest teaching hospitals? The answer was, again, social problems. They were different social problems. And hey, they weren't, you know, hunger, but they may have been domestic violence, housing instability, don't speak English as a first language, you know, insurance problems, addiction to drugs or alcohol. So we took the same model from Haiti and brought it to Boston.
You talk about bringing a tuberculosis model to Russia, but there's another detail in there, which is you went to George Soros, the Open Society, and said, will you please fund our project in Peru? And they said, well, actually, our attention right now is in Russia. And you wrote a letter to George Soros and said, actually, I think you're going about it the wrong way. And you told him about this multi-drug resistant approach. And he invited you to his office the next day and asked you to lead the project in Russia.
It's the basics of the story. That's right. So in essence, they said, no, we can't help you in Peru, but you can help us in Russia. But it's very compelling. You know, they were doing very good work and needed some tinkering on the clinical side. And just one figure, about a quarter of all people in the prison system with tuberculosis were dying when we started the project. And that's terrible. You know, it should be none. And 24% were dying. And when we introduced this new model in the prison system, the death rate went to zero in 1 year.
I want to go back to Haiti for a minute. When you were trying to get resources for your patients, you were going back and forth between Haiti and Harvard Medical School. I don't know how many Harvard Med students go to Haiti in their spare time and then come back and ace their exams. That must have been a challenging time for you. You took some resources from Harvard Med School to help the clinic in Haiti. You know, for instance, a microscope ended up in a Haitian clinic and some drugs. In fact, I think it was $92,000 worth of drugs that ended up in Haiti.
Well, Tom White paid for those eventually.
And by the way, it's ironic because Harvard Med loved you and you're a tenured professor there now. But how did you get away with that stuff?
Well, you know, the ethics of, I should plead the fifth, you know, but the ethics of distributive justice was what was on my mind, you know. you know, to go from Harvard to Haiti for years and years and years, to go to places where there's so many resources sort of stacked up in one area for medicine, you know, and to go, and you're there in 12 hours. You know, you're from the Brigham to the squatter settlement, it's about 12 hours.
And, 2 hours from Miami.
Even less, and a lot of that 12 hours, of course, is in vehicles, in jeeps or a car. To me, the big ethical question, let me leave aside my youthful peccadilloes, the chief ethical problem here is the ethics of poverty. You know, to claim, for example, that the United States is unrelated to Haiti is a nonsense. You know, the John Adams, in his History of the United States, said that we wouldn't even have the United States as it is today if not for Haiti, because of the Louisiana Purchase, which wouldn't have happened unless the Haitian Revolution occurred. And, you know, and it goes on and on. That's the late, you know, 18th, early 19th century. And it just, the connections got even tighter and tighter. I mean, we occupied Haiti militarily for 20 years in the 20th century. And so, to me, once I'd been in Haiti for a year, it stopped seeming vivid and different and started seeming more connected to my country. And even, to put it more baldly, affluence in one place seemed much more connected to poverty in another than I ever knew. And that, to me, was the big ethical issue, is how can we move resources rapidly to those who need them? And, you know, that's how Haitians see things as well. And I think they're right. Was that a decent answer to your provocative question about the missing microscope?
I think the comment, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission, is perfectly suited to this case of taking drugs from the medical school. And
well, you know, we did feel, too, and still feel to this day, that we'd like to permit institutions like Harvard to make a significant contribution to this work. But you can't do it just by creating experts. You have to move resources. And of course, universities and major teaching hospitals are not very nimble institutions. And it's not entirely popular, as you can imagine.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Paul Farmer, the co-founder of Partners in Health, an organization that strives to alleviate disease and poverty among the world's poorest populations. Paul got Partners in Health off the ground while he was a student at Harvard Medical School in the 1980s. So how much time are you spending out there talking to the public, talking to investors, and educating them, rather than, you know, in the field in Cange, Haiti, for example?
Well, you know, I like the way you said investors, and I didn't a few years ago. But I finally understand that notion. Mm-hmm. When I see so much shoddy philanthropy and mediocre healthcare in the poor world, including that which is connected to people from the United States and Europe, they're also not doing a great job. You know, philanthropists are going to give away money, mm-hmm. and that's what they do. And I'd rather they give it to this kind of work. I could say us, but I'll just say this kind of work, which is very lean in terms of the money being spent in the first world, and very lean on you know, spending a lot of money in management. And how much time am I doing that? A lot. 10 years ago, I would have just been kind of annoyed by having to do that sort of thing so much, but I'm not now. I really see it as the right thing to do.
We talk about how it might be easier for you now to raise money from investors, mm-hmm. Because you've proven yourself, you've gotten results. But in the early days, who were your other allies aside from Tom White? Were there other sort of monetary breakthroughs that you had?
Yes, there were. First of all, I mentioned the support from churches. And it was very interesting to me, because it's not what I would have anticipated, that some of our most loyal support came from church groups. And we got a big break in the late 90s when the Gates Foundation was developed. The Gates Foundation really did CPR on international health. I mean, it really resuscitated a field that was almost moribund and very gloomy and hangdog and whiny. And people were always saying, well, we'll never have enough money to do this, we'll never do that, we have to scale down our projects, we have to make it very simple and very cost-effective, and all this jargon. Some of these projects, alas, are very complex, and they're not easily dealt with without substantial investments of time and energy and money. And until the Gates Foundation came along, I think things were looking fairly grim.
How much did they give Partners in Health?
Well, actually went to a consortium of groups, through Harvard Medical School, to Partners in Health, to the Ministry of Health of Peru, to the World Health Organization, to the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta, and to a group called the Task Force for Child Survival. But that coalition, And that was $44 million. Huge grant.
And wasn't it, though, a last-minute coalition? Because you're all vying for support. And at the 11th hour, you decided, okay, well, if we're going to get this money, we need to cooperate.
Well, that's true. And, you know, Jim Kim was very involved, of course, in cobbling together this this coalition, and their senior medical advisor, Bill Foege.
You mentioned Jim Kim, who was your partner and co-founder of Partners in Health, and still is, but seems like he made you think big. Is that the case?
That's fair. Jim has always had this wonderful ability to think big.
In fact, before the Gates Foundation grant, I think you were going to ask for $2 to $4 million, and he said, well, why don't we ask for $45 million, just to give an example of his vision.
And, you know, that sounds arbitrary, but what I was saying was, why don't we ask for funding for the patients we plan to take care of in this one area of northern Lima? And he said, no, we should scale this up nationally. And so it wasn't about, you know, asking for 4 versus 40. It was really about two different projects. And Jim wanted not only to scale it up nationally, but also to try and, you know, export it to or replicate it in another site. And all that came to pass.
How large is Partners in Health now?
You know, we had a board meeting, Partners in Health board meeting, and someone in the senior staff at PIH did a head count. How many people work for Partners in Health? And it was 4,000 people. Only 60 of them in Boston, and the rest of them in the poor world where we're also concerned to create jobs. So, yeah, it was a small team 20 years ago, and all the people who labored so hard to get this off the ground are still working on this project.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you, Jessica, for having me.
My guest has been Paul Farmer, co-founder of Partners in Health. Coming up, we'll meet Alex Counts, founder and president of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to make loans to small business owners in almost 40 countries in the Middle East, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Alex founded the Grameen Foundation in 1997 after working with the pioneer of microfinance, Muhammad Yunus, at the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. Alex is the author of Small Loans, Big Dreams. Welcome.
Thank you.
What does Grameen mean?
Grameen, actually, many people think it's the name of the founder of the bank. And in fact, it is just a word in the Bengali language, which roughly translates as rural or village. And Grameen Bank was set up in Bangladesh to fill the gaps in lending. And one of the gaps were there wasn't nearly enough lending in the rural areas and the villages. So that led to the name evolving as the Grameen Bank.
Now, Muhammad Yunus is considered the pioneer of microfinance. What form did microfinance have prior to his coming on the scene?
Well, I think, you know, there's always been lending to people who wouldn't qualify for whatever the traditional lending, bank lending of that era was. People can go back to biblical times. But institutionalizing it, the way I think of it is Ray Kroc didn't invent the hamburger, but he did something with it that no one ever done before.
The founder of McDonald's?
The founder of McDonald's. But Dr. Yunus didn't invent lending to the poor, but he actually institutionalized it, franchised it, if you will, in a way that no one had ever done.
When did you first learn about microfinance or about Muhammad Yunus?
When I was at Cornell in the mid-80s, one of the things very striking of that era was there was a lot of student protest. It was Reagan administration, liberal campus, and people were protesting apartheid. And I just saw that I got no energy from working against things I didn't like. And through a series of discussions with mentors, I said, I want to find out on issues of poverty and injustice what was working in the world. Dr. Yunus and Grameen Bank came onto my radar screen, and it all started with a letter I wrote him my junior year where I basically kind of laid out how I thought I could help him expand on a global scale.
What exactly did the letter say?
Well, I'm sure if I could dig the letter up from his files, I'd be embarrassed by it in many ways, because I think I more or less proposed what must have sounded like the Eunice Count's plan to eradicate global poverty. Very simplistic and grandiose, and saying that I'd figured something out over beer and pizza one night in my, you know, on the campus, which is that if Grameen Bank could be applied in all the countries where poverty was pervasive, that you could really start to roll back global poverty. And despite the oversimplification and kind of grandiosity of it, he wrote me back, and he told me that I should first come and learn everything about Grameen, and I should try to learn the language of Bangladesh before I got there. And I was so encouraged that he took the time to write me back that that's exactly what I did.
Were you surprised to get the letter back from him, or were you like, yeah, of course, it's a good idea?
I was pretty surprised. What I was more surprised with is not that he replied, but he really took my idea seriously. And he saw the germ of something really good within me. And I think that's his secret. I think when he walks into a village, you know, he looks at a beggar woman and he sees a businesswoman. And so helps bring out of people their highest potential. So when he saw me reaching probably much farther than I had any right to about what I could do addressing global poverty, he saw in me that even without ever looking me in the eye, that I could do it. And of course, that set me and, you know, got me very excited.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that helps to provide credit to more than 9 million small business owners internationally. So you get a reply from Muhammad Yunus and he says, come to Bangladesh. So after graduation, you hopped on a plane, and what happens next?
Well, I've been fortunate. Both Cornell had a very dynamic language program, so I picked up some Bengali before I got there, which surprised everyone. And it was interesting because I went on a Fulbright scholarship, and there were delegations from the U.S. Embassy and Grameen Bank that went to pick me up. And I had a choice right there, what lifestyle, and I went with the Grameen folks. And for my first year there, I had almost no contact with Americans. I immersed myself in everything Grameen and really became an insider there.
What do you remember specifically? What are some examples of that year? Things that surprised you?
Yeah.
Things that weren't as set up as well as you thought? Or,
well, I think that when I first went out to the villages with Professor Yunus, how he was regarded as something of a kind of a savior, a hero in rural Bangladesh, and the closeness of the loan officers. You know, Dr. Yunus once said to me that if a branch manager who's been in his post for a year doesn't know the names of all the children of the 1,500 borrowers and their husbands' names, then he isn't doing his job, because he's just basically doing a transaction. He's not taking the interest he needs to in their overall well-being. But really, when I saw how, and my language skills got good enough to really draw out of women in conversations how they turn a $40 or a $60 loan to do something as simple as make cottage cheese and sell it to the shops in Dhaka. When I could draw that out of people in one-on-one conversations, I said, there's something about this that it's so elegant, so simple, and works well. And so that was very striking, that, again, banking, but so much more.
You started Grameen Foundation in 1997. Mm-hmm. Professor Yunus is on the board. And he gave you or lent you $6,000?
Well, what he did do is, around the time that we were setting it up, he had won a prize. But while he was waiting to bring the money into Bangladesh, he had earned some interest in an interest-bearing account. So he gave me the interest. Huh. And he said, this is your seed money to start Grameen Foundation. And so we turned that somehow or other into $100,000 in the first year. So, like many things associated with Grameen, it started very small, but it ends up being pretty substantial.
How old were you in 1997 when you started Grameen Foundation?
I had just turned 30.
What were some of the kind of important stepping stones in those in that critical early period? Like some important turning points for you?
To begin with, I really wasn't a good fundraiser at all. So a couple times we almost ran out of money. At one point, our auditor told us that our bank balance was down to $200, and I had like 6 or 7 staff at the time. So we were that close to being insolvent. A couple times I didn't even pay myself a salary for 3-4 months in a row, so we didn't run out of money. But I met kind of fortuitously in early 2000 I had a number of microfinance leaders who were applying the Grameen methodology in India, and they said, we need $1 million. And if you give us $1 million by the end of the year, we'll do great things. We can add more than 100,000 borrowers, but we need that up front. And this was what we were set up to do, but I was so intimidated, I was barely able to keep the lights on at the time. And I joined forces with Steve Rockefeller, Nelson Rockefeller's grandson, who said he was willing to help me, and we literally raised $1 million in 3 weeks.
How did you meet Steve Rockefeller?
I was invited at the time. Bankers Trust, which later became part of Deutsche Bank, was setting up a microfinance fund, kind of a quasi-commercial, quasi-philanthropic fund. And they were looking for someone new to the field. And so they asked me if I was willing to join the board as an advisor. And he was on the board. And we hit it off. A little mesmerized by his charisma and the name, I said, that's one guy I'm going to try to call and have coffee with. And within a year or so, that concrete project came on. I was panicked about how we were going to ever meet this goal. And I got up my courage to ask him to help me. And he said yes. It was really during that time with Steve's mentorship that I found my voice as a fundraiser. And one of the things I realized is that I was giving these wealthy people an opportunity to be part of something really important for meaning, for accomplishment that they wouldn't be able to have without me. And suddenly fundraising went from trying to take something from someone and leaving them with less, but really realizing that we're doing a deal with them, we're leaving them with more. Yeah. And I never looked back.
You had another turning point after raising $1 million with the help of Steve Rockefeller a couple years later, where you built your first credit facility, where you created leveraged pools of capital. You were able to raise roughly $30 million, which then could be leveraged to $140 million to loan. What was the catalyst for that?
Well, actually, I mentioned earlier that I raised $1 million with Steve Rockefeller, and we set out to raise $1 million the following year, and we weren't able to do that. We raised only a quarter of that amount for India. This was 2001. The economy had contracted and after the 9/11 attacks. So we were trying to scratch our heads. How do we get more leverage out of a reduced amount? And people thought about, what if we use the money we raised to give some sort of a partial guarantee to Indian banks to lend to these micro-lending organizations, lend them $1 million, and they could then use that to give out a lot of $100 loans, and we would be a kind of a partial guarantor because we had reduced amount of capital. And it actually worked. We used $250,000 to leverage $2.5 million. So that planted a seed of, my God, we're on to something here. And it might be not just in India. So we did a kind of a long shot. We pulled all these people together in the home of a venture capitalist, John Doerr. Founded Kleiner Perkins, was one of the early investors in Amazon and many of the really great West Coast companies, legendary venture capitalist. And people said, well, what could we actually do now that we've learned about the possibilities of microfinance? And he said, well, I'm told by the Grameen staff that if we were to collectively pledge 0.1% of our net worth, not give it, but pledge it to this loan guarantee pool, they could bring tens of millions of dollars, and probably we would never need to give them a cent, but we need to be willing to lose that amount. And that, people said, well, I might be willing to do that. And so it took us 10 months once we got the mandate from this group, but we were able to put together the facility, and they pledged collectively $31 million, and that allowed us over 5 years, where we were able to leverage more than $150 million, and there was not a single default, and it's funded on more than 1 million microloans.
And you had this meeting at John Doerr's house 8 days after your father died. Talk to me about the intensity of that period.
Well, it was, this is something we'd been building towards. A fundraising colleague, Barb Weber, also a good friend, put it together, and it was so improbable. We weren't on that strong financial footing at the time, Grameen Foundation. My father's health was uncertain, and I wasn't even sure I was able to go. It was the meeting that had been years in the planning, and yet somehow we pulled it off. And what was interesting was I found myself so kind of emotionally depleted, having just come from my father's funeral, and that one or two of my staff and one of my board members really took up the leadership role I play. I was very much in the background, and so it was a very complex, exciting negotiation with these, you know, 25 individuals who were there, and one that I just got to kind of sit back and observe the team that I'd assembled negotiate that with some of the people, the leaders of industry, and yet doing it really as peers, and that was thrilling.
Grameen Bank and Grameen Foundation is creating ancillary benefits other than simple poverty reduction, for example, decrease in domestic violence or a dissipation of, let's say, Hindu-Muslim conflicts. What are some examples of that?
When I was researching my book, Small Loans, Big Dreams, I met a woman, Amina Begum, who was one of the newest recruits in that village. And one of the things that was really striking is that, well, she had been didn't own any of her own land, nor did her husband, and so she was quite entrepreneurial, raising chickens and livestock, and yet as we learned and we interviewed her over time, sometimes when her husband wasn't there, that she said that her husband, frustrated with their poverty, had often taken in the past to beating her, and actually showed a place where she'd been beaten with a bicycle chain and just a scar under her chin that wasn't easily visible. And yet she explained this story that once she joined Grameen, she'd kind of gone into a little bit of a agreement with her other borrowing members who said they were going to come by. And knowing that the husband really liked having the working capital for the businesses that they went in together, that they told the husband kind of off the cuff that Grameen had a rule that if there was any abuse and beating in any household, that the loan capital was immediately cut off, which wasn't actually a rule. But they kind of scared him, and from that moment forward, that he neither beat her nor the children because he was afraid of losing the access to that capital. I thought about this village where there was a lot of centuries of the Hindus and Muslims living peacefully together, but in recent decades getting more tense, especially as there were conflicts within India, where it's a Hindu majority, and many of the Hindus that were a little more prosperous were leaving and migrating to India, and it was really leaving a hole in the social fabric of this village, Kolshi, in Bangladesh, which was the name of the village. And yet, when Grameen came in and started forming these solidarity groups, borrowing groups, the only way you could do it in most cases was to have groups that were both Hindus and Muslims together, women. And they began to socialize more and establish, you know, bonds of friendship. And what was interesting is that when I went back 10 years later to this village in Bangladesh where I'd lived and worked and was researching my book, is that more or less from that time onward, when Grameen had been around for a few years, the whole flight of the Hindus to India had stopped.
What is the default rate among the people you're lending to?
Except in cases of immediately after a natural disaster, typical default rates are 2-3%. So basically the same, more or less the same on commercial loans in the United States.
What percent of the recipients are women?
If you look at the organizations that Grameen Foundation supports, the majority of them are 100% women borrowers. And of the rest, it's anywhere between 50-90%. Microlending and the research shows this, and my own personal journeys to slums and villages, is that the women make better credit risks. They also use the profit to help give the children of the next generation the best chance to emerge from poverty by investing in health and education and nutrition of that next generation.
Right. Mm-hmm. Is there ever any stigma or trouble that results or resentment among the men because the women are receiving sometimes 100% of microfinance credit?
There's often tension. In fact, in many villages, one that I spent a lot of time in Bangladesh, the men in the village for 6 months didn't allow Grameen to operate. They said, we don't think this is a right kind of bank if you only lend to women. And so Grameen said, well, we'll wait around for a little while, but ultimately we'll just pull up stakes and go. And the men were like, well, this is the only place to get credit at a fair rate. And if you have this crazy policy about lending to women, I guess that's okay. And so, you know, there is tension, and then sometimes there's tension within the family. the man wants to use the loan for another different purpose than the woman applied for it. And this is where the group solidarity comes in, where if a woman is approached by her husband to divert the loan to another purpose, she goes and gets her friends in her borrowing group, and they come and try to convince the husband. And if that doesn't work, they bring the other women, bring their husbands. And if that doesn't work, you bring the staff from the bank so that the money goes into the productive uses that everyone agreed with. One of the things that men, if you talk to men who have had their women come into microfinance, is they'll say something like, I had no idea that my wife had this ability in business. And when she started working in business and earning income, it took pressure off me to have to provide for all the needs of the family. And it was a little shocking to see that part of her come out. But the microloan made it possible, and I saw a whole new side to my wife that I'd never seen before.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Alex Counts, founder of the Grameen Foundation, a microfinance organization that makes loans to small business owners across the globe. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.